Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. Given its enormous power, it's become fashionable to think of the Japanese economy as a machine. Indeed, a juggernaut operating in a sort of single-minded, monolithic way in the post-war era. What this image ignores is the historical context in which that economy developed, and the acute and complex socio-political arguments that revolved about questions as basic as, what is the point of an economy, and as specific as, is Japanese capitalism different, and if so, how? During the 20th century, six Japanese economists made profound contributions to answering those questions and forging Japan's economic direction. Their work illuminates both the origins of Japanese economic strategy and its continuing concerns. My guest is Laura Hine, professor of history at Northwestern University. Laura, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you.
Laura, we're going to learn about six men whose biography I think you were writing as a group.
That's right.
Their names, and let me see if I can do this correctly, are Aouchi, Arisawa, Wakimura, Takahashi, Minobe, and Tsuru.
That's right.
These are six extremely important and quite interesting economists, and of that six, only Mr. Tsuru, I think, is still alive.
That's right.
These men began their economic work early in the century, Laura, and is that in itself significant? I mean, economics as a discipline and its importance in Japanese society, was it sort of coming into being on its own right at the time they began to work?
Yes. Aouchi was the teacher of the others. He was born in 1888, and he's really in the first generation of economists. He himself does not have a degree in economics because it hadn't been really codified yet, but he went back to teach at the university when the new department was first established. And then the others are in the second wave, and they're very much part of an international community. Mm-hmm. Other people are doing the same thing in Europe and in the United States.
Isn't that an essential point right from the start, that they were that cosmopolitan and that open to influences from elsewhere in the world?
That's one of the things I find most impressive about them. They pay attention to the world outside their own country throughout their lives.
Mm-hmm. And to give some emphasis to that, Laura, I have the impression that in being cosmopolitan, open to foreign influences, they were also a sort of, in a sense, counter to the Japanese national ethos, which was very nationalistic at the time they began work, wasn't it? Or sort of very concerned with the national spirit and focused on sort of national purposes and so forth.
Yeah, but it's part. But really, the issue is how you define that. And I think the way they differed most greatly from a lot of their compatriots before the end of World War II is that they were looking for universal principles, and Japan is some maybe special case within that, but operating on social scientific principles, which they saw as the way the world worked. And there were a lot of other people who were looking for something that was more emotional and mystical and more special to Japan, and really reject that idea of being part of the greater world. So they were proud of their country, but they saw that in really different ways. And there they were quite different from a lot of other trained social scientists of their day in the 1920s and 30s. I know other people who've worked on anthropologists, for example, or urban planners. And they had what now is kind of, seems to me, a kind of a creepy view of the way things were. And Aouchi himself was extremely critical of other economists who were claiming that economic principles worked differently in Japan because it was a country run by the emperor. And, you know, he had really contemptuous things to say about them. It was, you know, their economics was like old dead fish.
That's pretty cool.
he had a lot of flair. He's a fun writer.
Well, tell me something, Laura. Is that the essence of their contribution, this focus on scientific method, on logic, and perhaps most of all, the importance of statistics in economic theory in Japan?
I think that is one of the things that is at the heart of their thinking. And it has strengths and weaknesses. There's a lot of contemporary now criticism of that way of thinking as you know, forcing everybody into one mold. There's a lot of cultural critique of it, and also of going for what may even be a kind of a cruel solution because it's one that makes everybody fit to the same principle. So I think, you know, they're open to that criticism like their entire generation.
Right.
But if you look at what they were positioning themselves against, it's a lot more attractive, I think, than the idea that, you know, the Japanese spirit will overcome all obstacles.
We will come back to that very point, the narrowness of their approach, and perhaps, if you can call it that, as a flaw, and some of the issues it may be raising in our own time. But I'm struck by the fact that they were making this particular contribution, that beginning that early in the century, and then sort of sustaining their effort over six decades. That's a long time for a group to be active.
You know, I am really impressed by their can-do attitude. They really wanted to make a difference, and they did stick with that. And that's just sustaining that level of energy is impressive to me, but also of public-spiritedness, that these were people who went on trying to change their world for a long, long time. And lots of people aren't able to do that.
One reason I think they might have been making those choices is that they seem to be concerned about the social welfare of the Japanese right from the start. I'm thinking that there was a book, The Tale of Poverty, that seemed to have been very important to their thinking about an economy that would help sort of the least protected or the least able.
Yeah, they wanted to make a difference, is really what it is. And the social problems of urban slums, of harsh working conditions, and of impoverished farmers were the big social problems of the 1920s and the 1930s. And they wanted their work to address those problems in some way. And they found that to raise those issues put them in opposition with the government, and that they thought was wrong. And went on pushing in that direction.
You're speaking, as you know, to a non-economist, and help me with this. Was that, in a sense, well, I think of it this way, as two concerns perhaps being at the core of their sense of a, quote, Japanese economy. First of all, as we mentioned earlier, statistical measurement and the scientific method is being essential, but also social concern that there would be the capitalism, which, you know, would get a conscience in a sense. Is that, in essence?
Yes, that's absolutely right. And in the post-war period, that's what they say over and over again, that capitalism has evolved to the point where it incorporates some of the measures that alleviate conflict between the classes, which they still see as central.
There's another aspect to these men that I want us to focus on, at least momentarily, because I find it profoundly interesting just on the human level. Their bond was so powerful. It's almost familial. Maybe it is familial. I mean, they stuck together. And that, again, over six decades. Would you comment on that?
Well, I think that's, it is remarkable. They do have a connection that's very strong. They write together for years and years and years. They organize this little study groups on 20 different topics over the course of their lives. And then they'll meet once a month and talk to each other and go out for dinner afterwards. But in general, in Japan, people hold on to their connections more than in the United States. We're such a rootless society here. And there are a lot more formal mechanisms by which people maintain them. It's very common for grown-ups in Japan to have regular reunions with their kindergarten school classmates. And often when a group leaves, say, college, somebody will be designated as the person who keeps track of where everybody is and their addresses. And then once a year, they'll have some kind of reunions, so that they're part of a tradition that's much stronger in Japan than here, but I think they are a particularly strong example of it. It's partly because they're so elite. They come from, you know, they went to the most prestigious college in the entire country, and when they did so, it was still a fairly small group. So they do have something special in common.
I appreciate that. So I see them as exemplars of kind of a Japanese cultural tradition in a way. But also they suffered together, didn't they not? I mean, it was in terms of the oppression they had to deal with of their intellectual argument, and then, of course, World War II.
Yeah, they. I mean, that's something they share with everyone in the entire country, and it is a bond. But they can be free with each other. They really know each other extremely well. There are a number of interviews that were done with these men towards the ends of their lives, often getting them together in groups to talk about some aspect of their life's work. And one of the things that's most striking about them is that in the transcripts of the interviews, every third or fourth line, there'll be a little parentheses with the character for laughing in it. Really? They're all just sort of joking and laughing and making fun of each other in a nice, friendly way. And you can tell that there's an affection that goes way, way back.
Gosh, I really look forward to this biography. Okay. I must say. Laura, I want to turn us to World War II in just a moment, its effect on these men and, of course, on Japan. But let me take a moment from our conversation first to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Laura Hine, professor of history at Northwestern University. World War II, Laura, as you've pointed out, for all Japanese, this was a traumatic experience, not just for our six principal subjects here, but I'm wondering, even in the briefest sense, what you might say they derived as, quote, the lessons of the experience. I mean, two things occur to me, and let me offer them, see if I'm right or wrong. First of all, that it, in a kind of extraordinary way, probably did reaffirm the usefulness of technology. I mean, that's, after all, what war production is all about. But these men had, I would think, an innate suspicion of ideology. I mean, and they probably got that reinforced, too, as a result of the war's outcome. Is that right?
Both those things are right, I think, that... one of the things that was so remarkable about the Allied occupation of Japan was all the stuff they brought with them.
Uh-huh,
they had so much equipment, and they were so tall and young and healthy compared to the people who arrived. That was a big shock for everybody. Of course, these men had all traveled abroad in the pre-war period. They had been to Europe. They had been to the United States. And like many people who had done so, they had a sense of the incredible wealth and power of the principal adversaries. And they were not surprised by the fact that Japan lost the war.
Because they were in closer contact with...
Because they knew what they were up against.
Yeah. You know, there's an interesting fact here, if I interpreted correctly what you've written about them, Laura, that when they recount their experiences during the war, how to put this, there's a kind of an emotional restraint about it, or at least you don't get or seem to get the full flavoring of what did you do in the war, Daddy, and how did it affect you? Is that...
Yeah, they have essentially sort of codes of conduct, I think, that they set for themselves about how to deal with any kind of negative experience in their life. And they, I think, are thinking of themselves as teachers and as moral exemplars. So they try not to be bitter. And to talk about it in a way that emphasizes their willingness to go on trying and their willingness to do the best they can under trying circumstances without complaining.
Right.
And they were terribly trying circumstances. Arisawa's infant daughter died at, right after the end of the war because of malnutrition and poor medical care. And all of them had a very difficult war.
Right. Loss of jobs.
They all lost their jobs. Right. And their job was the one thing that they were really bitter about because they were acquitted of the crime of thought crimes, of attitudes against the government in 1944. Very impressive at that late date in the war to be acquitted. And then they were told, no, you can't have your job back anyways. And Wakimura, when he pressed for an explanation, he really thought he was going to get his job back, and he wanted it back. And they didn't have very much money at that point either. They told him, no, it's like a ritual defilement, and used the religious language of Shinto to explain to him why he couldn't have the job back. You know, it's not something that you've done, you just become tainted. And he was really appalled by that. And that is the one occasion where he writes with real bitterness about his treatment, that these were his peers and the people that he thought would be the most broad-minded, and they turned out to be less broad-minded than the prosecutors and judges who he hadn't expected much help from at all.
And that's a very evocative incident. But for the most part, they were sort of silent. Or largely silent about
Yeah,
at the
I mean, they
Pentagon.
talk about the way in which the war was hard on scholarship. They talk about promising young men who were cut down and therefore couldn't offer the community the results of their education and ideas.
In the post-war era, the Laura, when they are again able to make contributions to the forging of Japanese economic thinking, are they essentially the same? That is to say, the continued emphasis on the importance of statistical measurement and the scientific method and so forth. But perhaps with one, well, they've been teaching this all the time, but maybe in the post-war era it has added significance, and that is that this provision of statistics is, in a very profound way, a kind of a pillar of democracy. They're giving the public information, which is what democracy should be about.
I think the big difference between their pre and post 1945 thinking is that they grow more wary of the power of the state, that they're very attracted to state managed, state led economies in the 1930s. And then they start thinking about this partly because of their own experiences and partly because of just the sheer stupidity of the Japan's war. I mean, it can be faulted in many, many ways, but one of the most obvious ones was that they picked a fight they couldn't win. You know, even if you believe in all of the goals, which I don't think these men did at all, that one everybody could agree was a problem. And so they really thought hard about why that had been, and arrogance and stupidity and a lack of respect for the facts, the economic facts, was one of the things that they thought was a big problem. And in fact, they had been active in advising the government, told them, we don't think you can win this war. And the government had said, well, your statistics are excellent, your reasoning derives directly from it, but your conclusions are against national policy, so we're going to ignore them. And they wanted to create a system where that couldn't happen again, where if it was clear that they didn't have the economic might to do something, then it wouldn't be done. And they thought the best way to do that is to open everything up to scrutiny by the citizens and to make it possible for people to really understand and see what was going on. And so they were interested both in making all kinds of economic decision-making public knowledge so that you could get the information and also training people so that they could understand it. And so they put a lot of effort into economics education at every level from junior high school textbooks on up.
Excellent. Laura, explain this for me. I ask this with some trepidation because I can only pronounce it as a concept without perhaps fully explaining it. But I understand that as a facet or feature of the Japanese economy, there was a concept or a theory of dualism in which, and here I tread very cautiously, but that on the one hand, sort of sophisticated industrial production would be encouraged with high-tech jobs, skilled labor, etc., and all that implies, while traditional and sort of low-tech, I guess primarily agrarian forms of economy would also be encouraged. You would have this dualism would be both of them going at the same. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not linked to Japan alone. I mean, this is a more general concept that other people have used too. And the basic idea is if you have a huge population and a lot of the people are working in jobs that have very low productivity, and it's usually agriculture. They can eke out a living on the farm, but they're all very, very poor. And there are a growing number of industrialized jobs, usually in the cities, but because there's so many people who are waiting for a chance to get at better jobs, who you know, the more there are, the more people will be lining up at the gates to try and get them, wages are kept very low. And so the problem is, how do you raise wages? How do you raise consumption? How do you get people so that their standard of living is a little bit higher more generally? And that was precisely what they were concerned about in the early post-war Japanese economy, pre-war as well. And the question is, how do you move from that situation to one in which more people have good jobs? What steps do you take to get from one situation to another? And it's not obvious, and there were a lot of arguments over precisely that.
So there, again, stop me before I get this terribly wrong, but their concern was how to control that, right? How to make sure that happened in such a way that it wouldn't be disruptive? Or
how to make it happen.
How to make it happen.
In such a way that you didn't just go on with two groups of people, one who was completely cut off from a higher standard of living for generations and generations.
Well, you know, it strikes me that that must be a terribly difficult thing even to try. Because, I mean, just the fact of encouraging, and Japan's success, to my mind, and in our time, has, of course, been the high-tech side of the equation. I mean, how do you, it seems the capacity of one sector, particularly the industrial sector, to really grow at the expense of the other seems to me to be one of the things that would be very difficult to control.
Yeah, I mean, they did it through higher productivity, through developing export markets for sophisticated goods, and also by developing a much larger domestic market. And one of the things that these men were very active in doing is arguing that there had to be, it was really important to make sure that Japanese at home enjoyed a higher standard of living and were able to purchase the new commodities that they were increasingly trying to build, that it wasn't just enough to try and sell first-rate transistor radios and then cars in the United States. They had to try and do it at home. And anybody who's gone back to Japan regularly over the post-war period, you can really see the transformation.
Right.
It's incredible.
It has been incredible, Laura. But as you pointed out earlier, it hasn't been without problems. And even in the contributions that these men have made, there are, of course, some difficulties, some areas of difficulty. And I wanted you to, I would love for you now at this point to perhaps elaborate on a couple of them. One is the very, and you mentioned this earlier, the narrowness of their approach to the economy, the extraordinary emphasis on statistics, and perhaps the fact that this would have left out other factors that are perhaps more emotional or human or social, if you will, but equally important to forging economic thinking.
I think one of their real blind spots was gender. They tended to think of families as households with a male income earner, and in Japan, as in the United States, that's less and less the case, and more women are working full-time. But the opportunities for them are not so strong. It's very, very hard to work and raise children at the same time there. It's just the very, very inflexible system. And one of the characteristics of the Japanese system is that there's a lot of reward for staying in the job for many, many years, so that if you leave the workforce and then come back again, you tend to come back at minimum wage. And so that was something that they were not very concerned about because they were thinking of male household heads. And it meant that women's work has gone on being very low paid in Japan relative to men's work. And so that's something that they were just not concerned about, even though they were concerned about certain groups of people being stuck in low wages forever. Right. So that's, I think, they were very insensitive to that. They were also concerned about developing industry very rapidly, and like everyone else in their generation, were slow to think about pollution issues and quality of life issues, although to give them credit, they were among the first to do so. Tsurushi Geto is really the key person to make an economic argument against pollution, and he's a major figure in that.
It's interesting. That problem actually ironically grew out of their success, didn't it? I mean, the industrialization proceeding apace, the faith in technology, but perhaps the lack of sufficient environmental concern.
Certainly. And there again, I see them as very much like everyone else in the world, that these were the mistakes that everybody was making at that time.
That's an interesting fact, and I think it bears emphasis in that throughout their careers, they were so connected to, I think, the world economic community, is that particularly in among industrialized nations.
Absolutely, and not just the economic community, political community. They're interested in The British Labour Party after the war, for example, they all write about different aspects of their policies. And they look to see, they look for ideas elsewhere. You know, why invent everything fresh if you can get some ideas for somewhere else? And also, they look for to ahead to see what kinds of problems are coming. Said, well, we can see this is going on here and this is going on here. Do we have reason to suppose we're going to run up against the same problems or not?
So this is a view of Japan in the world, I mean, as an active participant in world affairs throughout.
And not just in the world and in interaction with the rest of the world, but also operating by more or less the same principles as elsewhere. So again, I think it's their original insight that really keeps them with that.
They're a fascinating group of men, Laura, and I certainly look forward to the biography that you're writing about them. Let me ask you this question in conclusion about their contribution, because I think as anyone listening will understand, it's multifaceted. And again, in my sense of them, it was, of course, economics at the core, but more than economics. It was a contribution that went beyond economics in a sense, and perhaps changed, indeed, I do believe, changed the nature of Japanese political culture, because I think that we view and consider rightly Japan these days as a nation committed to pacifism. And that seems to be one of the things that would proceed directly from their work, or at least their thinking about it. So should we think of them as architects of Japanese society and as well as being builders of the economy?
Well, they certainly would hope to be remembered that way. They were active politically. They were very, very active in the peace movement in post-war Japan. And always saw their work as in part opening up the political implications of their economic ideas. That's one of the things I think is interesting about them, because so much of economics work theoretically operates as though there is no spillover into other parts of the world. And I think a lot of very thoughtful economists all over the world are troubled by that and look for ways to connect up their moral and political and social concerns with their understanding about how economies work. They tried very hard to put those together.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a wonderful statement, Laura, to make to conclude our conversation, worth remembering. Thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today. Enjoyed it. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Laura Hine. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at radiodial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at WWICS.SI.EDU.